All right. So last time we had gone through the elementary derivation of like time dilation and worked out how the position and time transform when you look at them in different inertial reference frames. Today we're going to formalize some of those concepts, and that will require developing a little bit of a math toolkit for talking about relativity and four vectors, which requires a bit of an investment, like a lot of this, both semesters of this course have been, to get used to this toolkit, this language, terminology of four vectors, and how their transformation properties behave when looked at in different inertial systems. This will pay off when we start transforming the electromagnetic fields or look at charged particles radiating from different reference frames. But even already today, it'll pay off in giving a almost trivial derivation of the relativistic Doppler effect, which is a pretty cool thing, that if you remember one idea, you can rederive the relativistic Doppler effect in just a couple of lines. So let me introduce the idea of four vectors. So starting with a three vector, right? If we write, first of all, a vector in three-dimensional space, by its three components, x1, x2, x3. And maybe I should preface all of this by saying, at the moment I'm not being careful, but we will soon be encountering superscripts and subscripts, and talk about the difference between covariant and contravariant vectors. At the moment, I'm not going to be careful about distinguishing these, so you can just think here I'm just writing the three ordinary components of a vector in x, y, and z coordinates. But later, there's going to be a difference between these two quantities, and at that point, I'll start trying to be careful about that. But for instance, a similar notation for a four vector, we will write as like the time and position four vector x will be its first component, or we sometimes call that the time component of a four vector, which is then followed by three spatial components referring to an XYZ coordinate system in space. So we'll use this notation, x, without a vector on top of it to indicate a four vector. Or when we really want to emphasize that it has four components and want to be able to distinguish those, we'll denote it as x superscript alpha. Okay. So we've seen that this time and position for a vector obeys this Lorentz transformation that we worked out last time. And just to remind you, the logic of that derivation was to find an invariant and then do basically just as you have an invariant in three-dimensional or two-dimensional rotations that lead to a rotation matrix that we derived, then you could, because the invariant has a difference of squares instead of a sum of squares, we could use that idea of an invariant to derive this transformation law between x prime and t prime for a velocity along the x-axis. So the definition of a four vector you have any collection of four quantities, that obey the same transformation law as this time position four vector, which we call the Lorentz transformation, any such quantity we can call a four vector. And there will be many types of different four vectors we're going to encounter. And once you've identified a quantity as a four vector, a whole lot of things become clear about it, especially its transformation properties. So let's pick some random quantity, A, which is, we'll have a time component, time-like component, I should say. It might have nothing to do at all with time, but there is a first part which is a scalar, and then there are the x, y, and z components of that vector, which we also sometimes indicate by an ordinary three-vector notation. So we'll sometimes write it that way. And so this will be a four vector if, when this quantity, when you transform it or look at it in a different reference frame, it will get four new components. A0 prime, A1 prime, A2 prime, and A3 prime. And these components are related to the original ones by the same Lorentz transformation law, namely A0 prime is gamma times A0 minus the dot product of beta with A. And the parallel components of A prime will be gamma times the parallel components in the unprimed inertial frame minus beta times the time component in the unprimed frame, and the perpendicular components in the primed frame are equal to the perpendicular components in the unprime. Yeah. We have another factor of what?
Like C is squared.
Well, A has a set of, all the components of A are in the same units, and beta is dimensionless, right? So we want every term to have the same units. You think there should be a C somewhere? Well, whatever the quantity is, like here, if you need a C to make all the components of the four vector have the same units, where is it? Yeah. Like here, of course, time has to be multiplied by C so that all these four entities have the same units. Similarly, these will all have the same units, so they may or may not need a C to accomplish that. We'll see an example of this in a minute. Okay, so we will write the mathematical representation of a Lorentz transformation as a matrix multiplication, which was in fact how we first derived it, although just for a very simple geometry So X alpha prime we'll write as lambda alpha beta times X beta. And this uses the Einstein summation convention. Right, so whenever you see a repeated index in an expression like this, means you sum over the repeated index over all its values. So this allows us to simplify a lot of formulas by not having to write the summation symbol. And so we can cast this transformation as a matrix multiplying the unprimed four vector components. And in general, any four vector, by definition, then will obey with the same transformation matrix that transforms position and time. It will also obey. A alpha prime is the sum over beta, lambda alpha beta, A beta. And there is a pattern to this, you know, where you have a superscript or a subscript, but that's not clear yet because I haven't defined that notation, but that's coming soon. Just one brief aside that we derived this with this simple geometry that the relative velocities of the two K and K prime frames was V along the x-axis, but if beta, meaning V over C, if the velocity vector of the two frames relative to each other is more complicated, some angle, right, then there's a more general form that's useful to know. This is equation 1119 in the text. X naught prime is this gamma times X naught minus beta dot X. This the spatial part of X, and X prime is X plus, which is a more complicated looking formula, gamma minus 1 over beta squared times beta dot X times beta minus gamma X naught, the 3 vector beta. A useful formula to know in case you have not the simplest geometry of the relative velocity vector along one of the Cartesian axes. So we can now generalize the idea we had in three dimensions of a scalar product, which is a useful concept. Right, ordinary 3D, we have a vector like x dot y, right? Sum over components, xi, yi. And this is a special thing in that it's an invariant. You can take a dot product of two vectors in 3D. You could look at this in any coordinate system, any rotated coordinate system. It's always the same number. You can even apply rotation to the vectors. As long as you rotate both of them the same amount, it does not change. So that's a scalar, or it's an invariant under the rotation transformations in three dimensions. So similarly, there is an invariant scalar product in our four-dimensional world of space-time. Which we've already encountered, which I guess I'll put up here. Which we'll write x dot y for any two four vectors, which is x naught y naught minus x dot y. Right, so we have this minus sign instead of a plus sign like we had for all the components being multiplied in the 3D case. So this is a scalar, so if you do a Lorentz transformation and calculate the components of the x and y four vectors, you will get the exact same number in every inertial reference frame. So this is a scalar. Usually it's said this way, that it's a scalar with respect to generalized Lorentz transformations. Which has as a subset ordinary 3D rotations of the space part of the vector. So this generalized Lorentz transformation allows for the velocity changing inertial reference frames, but also simple rotations. Okay, so now I think it's time to be careful about this contravariant, covariant stuff and develop a systematic way of using those, which is pretty cool. It kind of eliminates most of the simple errors you might find yourself making. Okay, so here's our careful notation. So we will write a scalar product of two four vectors when we want to be fully explicit. We might write this summation symbol from alpha equals 0 to 3 of x alpha times y alpha, summed over alpha. And again, this in the Einstein notation is just x alpha, y alpha. And this would also equal x sub alpha, y superscript alpha. And it would not equal x alpha, x sub alpha, y sub alpha. This would be a different quantity. So let me explain what I'm talking about here. So when we write a superscript on any four vector, this is a collection of four objects which are basically just the ordinary vector components and scalar components okay, just like x, y, z. Let me just write it that way, like x, y, z. In other words, like I wrote before, x naught and the ordinary three-dimensional vector x. Okay, and this vector with the superscript are called the contravariant components of the four vector. Of the four vector x. Now y sub alpha here, on the other hand, is the time-like part of the four vector y, and the negative of the ordinary three-dimensional vector for the space part of the four vector. And these are what are called the covariant components of the four vector y. Now, this language comes from tensors, from tensor algebra. I had a course in this as an undergraduate at Nebraska. And you see in Riemannian, with Riemann surfaces and so on, and in general relativity, these ideas are especially important. Here it's kind of trivial in flat space. But it's useful to get used to this, and we'll see how it pays off, especially when we transform the fields in the coming weeks. Okay, so first rule is that an invariant, to make an invariant out of two four vectors, which is this four-dimensional dot product, right? Or a scalar is always formed by taking the contravariant components and of one vector times the covariant components of the other vector. And so sometimes it's called a contraction, this and that means the following. It's in the following spirit, that after you have contracted an index, in this case you're contracting the alpha index here on these four vectors to make this invariant. It's because after you've summed over it, you've got a quantity that no longer depends on the index. You've kind of eliminated now the index by taking one contravariant, one covariant index of the two four vectors and summing. Now you have a quantity that no longer depends on that index. Only depends on the nature of the four vectors and is the same in every reference frame. So,
do you know why they're called covariant and contravariant?
I don't actually know that.
So I was just thinking about it now. It's a little curious. Probably going to have to look it up
actually. Yeah, But one thing you might just try to remember is when you see the contravariant there you've just got the ordinary vector components without any extra minus signs. But with the covariant, you have to keep track and add the minus sign to the space part of the three-dimensional vector part. So let's look at one example of this. Let's say you have two, four displacements, okay? That could be two explosions, right? Boom, 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 boom here, number one, and over here, maybe some other position, some other time, event two. And if these are happening actually close to each other in time and space, one might view this as having a differential displacement. So there will be an invariant interval between these two events in space-time. And we could write this invariant as ds squared, which would be the contravariant difference between the contravariant components of the space-time vector contracted with the covariant components. Right, so this would be d x naught squared minus the length of the three-dimensional vector squared. Now, you can always interconvert between covariant and contravariant components. They're equivalent information, just represented in different ways. And we sometimes will need to convert from one to the other. Like, say, someone gives you the contravariant components of two vectors and tells you to make their invariant product, then you'll have to convert one of them to a covariant vector in order to apply the formula for a scalar product. Okay, so this conversion can be accomplished using something called the metric tensor. Whispers.
I was commenting about how we're using a different sign convention that presses happy with.
I'm used to seeing time negative, so I'm just like keeping it in my brain.
Oh, okay. Sorry to mess up with your brain. Is that how Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler does it? The general relativity? Or is just what you learned as an undergrad?
So I'm also sitting in GR right now.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, there are different conventions. Some people keep track of the minus sign by using I floating around in various places. Okay, so let's define the metric tensor. And this again will get more complicated in general relativity where you have curved space-time. But we are in flat space, and there the metric tensor has these as its covariant elements. It's a diagonal matrix in flat space-time, this 4x4 matrix. Where the rows and columns, the first is the time-like component, and the space-like components are all minus ones. And this is the same, again, in flat space, as the contravariant components of the metric tensor. So the conversion between contra and covariant components is just this matrix multiplication. X alpha is G superscript alpha superscript beta times X beta. And the reverse happens the same way. X covariant components is G subscript alpha beta times X superscript beta to convert contravariant components into covariant components. And whenever you have contractions like this, one of the indices better be up and one had better be down. So we could also write, for instance, our displacement here as ds squared is g alpha beta x alpha x beta. It would be an equivalent way of writing it in this notation. Okay, so that, again, this whole language of metric tensor goes back to differential geometry or tensor analysis. One more kind of general math point about general transformation theory before we apply this to a physics problem. What you learn, like in a tensor or differential geometry course, is that we can write the transformation from one inertial frame to another as like the contravariant components of vector x in frame k prime can be written as the partial derivatives of the contravariant components with respect to the contravariant components. Sorry, the partial derivative of the primed contravariant components with respect to the unprimed contravariant components, and then a contraction with the contravariant components in the unprimed frame. And so this partial derivative that plays a key role in this, x partial x prime alpha partial x superscript beta, is the matrix lambda alpha beta, and that's our transformation matrix, Lorentz transformation. And any contravariant four vector will transform according to that law. Namely, A prime, its contravariant components, would be a contraction of lambda super alpha sub beta with the contravariant A sub beta. And this, it will be a contravariant in both frames. And one thing you'll notice is if you take a derivative relative to a contravariant component, that has covariant properties with respect to that index. Okay. Whereas taking the derivative of a quantity that is contravariant, that retains the contravariant properties in that index. On the other hand, if you have a quantity who has a transformation law, has a different formula, namely, let's pick some covariant components of a vector B alpha prime. Its transformation law will be dx superscript beta with respect to dx prime subscript alpha, superscript alpha. If this is the transformation law of a quantity B between two inertial reference frames, then that means that the B alphas are the components of the covariant components of a four vector. And this would also be sometimes called a tensor of rank one. Okay, enough of the math. Yeah.
So there's a difference between what you just wrote and then like the x prime super alpha transformation?
Yeah, I think basically this is the prime is in the numerator over there, right? And in the denominator here. And again, you can relate these, I think, with the metric tensor, but I shouldn't write it because I'm not 100% sure that that's all it is. I think that's how you relate them. But I think this is going to be the covariant components might just involve the metric tensor times the lambda to convert one to the other. But I'm not an expert on this notation, so I don't have that on the top of my head right now. But yeah, this is a different quantity than that. Okay, let's do the Doppler effect. And I brought an experimental paper. If I get through this derivation now, I'll show you a real-world example that really amazed me when I was a graduate student of how you can make use of a really big relativistic Doppler shift to do an experiment that would be really hard to do otherwise. Okay. And I'm going to derive this Doppler effect by invariance arguments, as you'll see. And if you remember the idea, you can derive this, like if you're on a desert island, I'm trying to remember, what was the Doppler effect derivation again? You can do it in just two lines. So let's start by considering a plane wave. Like of electromagnetic radiation or anything. Okay. In a plane wave, let's write 1, e to the I times k dot r minus omega t. We can regard this as exponential of I times a real phase. Call that phase phi. And phi here, to make sense, it's just counting wave crests that go by. It's the number of wave crests going by is an integer. It has to be an invariant. It has to be the same in all reference frames. And that's really all you need to know, plus the fact that the invariant looks a lot like a dot, a 4D, four-dimensional dot product or a scalar product, is all we're going to need to derive this Doppler effect. So let me write that. Scalar, I'll write it this way, minus phi as omega over c times the time part of a position minus the three-dimensional scalar product of the two space parts of the four involving the four vector x. Okay. And since this is an invariant and it's clearly mathematically the scalar product of something with the time and position 4 vector, that means if we define k alpha as omega over c for its time part and k vector, 3D vector, for its space part, this must be a 4 vector by this argument. Because its contraction with a known 4 vector gives a scalar, gives an invariant. So now we know the transformation law of this 4 vector, and we can write it down, and that's the Doppler effect. How frequency and wave vector look in different reference frames. Okay, so let's first write k in terms of the spatial part of k in parallel and perpendicular components to the relative velocity vector between the frames. And I'll call the parallel component, again, we're talking about parallel to the relative velocity, which is c beta. So the parallel component we'll call k parallel, and the perpendicular component we'll call k perpendicular, which are vectors, right? So that the full spatial part of the wave vector here is k parallel, broken down into these separate components where beta dot k perpendicular is zero. Okay, then the transformation law is just the Lorentz, the first equation being that k perpendicular prime is equal to k perpendicular. Components of the wave vector perpendicular to the relative motion are unchanged in the two frames. The time part of the 4 vector transforms just like the CT does in the time and position 4 vector, namely k naught prime, which is omega prime over c, will be gamma times k naught minus beta k, the parallel components of k, which is also gamma times omega over c minus beta k parallel. And thirdly, the wave vector components parallel in the primed frame will equal gamma times the parallel component in the unprimed frame minus beta times k naught, which again is omega over c. So that is the two-line derivation of the relativistic Doppler effect, which we'll now explore a little bit. Okay, so for electromagnetic radiation in free space, then the magnitude of the three-dimensional part of K vector is, of course, equal to omega over C. And so you can also write Vk parallel as V times the magnitude of K times cosine of the angle that K is forming relative to the velocity axis. Okay. So that's also V over C omega cosine theta. Okay, right, theta equals angle between V and K. And I should point out that's not equal to theta prime, because the parallel and perpendicular components transform differently. Okay, so in terms of frequency, which is usually the simplest observable to measure, omega prime is gamma omega times 1 minus that cosine theta, which I can illustrate with a diagram. And you all remember gamma. Can't forget your gamma. And you might just keep in mind, gamma can be quite large in ultra-relativistic situations. It could be 1,000, 1,000,000, like at a relativistic particle accelerator. Could be really, really big. Okay, so let's set this up with a reference frame. I'll have three reference frames here. I'll have K, where a monochromatic source of light goes off of frequency omega in its rest frame, and it's sending out radiation in all directions. And I'm going to have that going toward and away from an observer, two observers. So in reference frame here, K double prime moving toward the light source. Here's our observer is going to observe omega double prime. This frame is going toward the source, velocity V. And there's going to be a wave, it's going to see this wave vector going toward it. And the observer here in this frame, which I'll call K prime, moving to the right at velocity V, away from the source. Again, we have our observer. We'll see omega prime. Okay. And of course, this is theta equals zero, is the angle between its K that its photons that it observes is, are parallel to V, whereas these are anti-parallel, so these are theta equals pi in our formula. So this will see omega double prime. Blue shifted to higher frequency compared to the original source. And I like to think of that, I'm running right into the beam. So of course I see it with more energy photons. I'm really running right toward the source. Photons are have more energy from my point of view. Whereas here I'm running away from the photons. And so the photons that collide with me have less energy. And we call those redshifted. And we can work out the math. The theta equals zero case, the red shifted, where k is parallel to v, means omega prime will be gamma times 1 minus beta omega, which is also 1 minus beta over root 1 minus beta squared. So that becomes 1 minus beta over 1 plus beta to the 1/2 times omega. And you see omega prime is reduced since beta is a number between 0 and 1. And the theta equals pi case, which is relevant to our k double prime observer, where k is parallel to minus the velocity. Now omega double prime is gamma times 1 plus beta omega, and do the same kind of algebra, you get 1 plus beta over 1 minus beta to the 1/2 times omega, and you see it's going to be larger than omega. I think you're right. Yep, thank you. Thanks. So these are the cases where you're either running toward or away longitudinally, parallel or anti-parallel to the velocity. So that's called the longitudinal Doppler effect. But you could also look at right angles to the velocity. And there you still see a Doppler effect. That's called the transverse Doppler effect. Okay, where theta is 90 degrees, you're looking at k vectors perpendicular to your relative velocity vector, and there omega prime is simply gamma omega, because the cosine is zero, or just omega over root 1 minus beta squared. Okay. So even though the transverse components of the position are not affected by a Lorentz transformation, you can sort of think that because omega has a time in it, it is affected by, even though k perpendicular is not. And I had a mention of an experimental paper in the notes that has confirmed these formulas for the Doppler effect to many decimal places, like 7 decimal places or so. So it has been confirmed experimentally. But I thought I'd show you another experiment that actually was important to me when I was a graduate student. I ended up working on it. some aspects. So let me pull up a paper that amazed me at the time. Okay, so let me set up the problem. That is the paper, 1977. Just about 3 months after I enrolled at the University of Chicago for grad school. In fact, that's the same month I joined Fano's group. So, here's the experiment. You want to have a laser hit the H- ion, right? That's a hydrogen atom plus an electron. This is bound by about 3/4 of an electron volt. The extra electron can be tacked onto a hydrogen atom. But you wanted to excite this up near, not just to knock off the electron with by hitting it with a 0.75 eV photon. You want to knock it off and excite the hydrogen atom up to, let's say, n equals 2. And that requires photons that are up to about 11 electron volts in energy. Now that's pretty hard frequency range, those of you who know lasers. That's not a real easy range to make a laser at 11 eV. You know, you can make a 2 eV photon laser or visible laser. Those are not such a big problem, 2 to maybe 4 eV. But to make an 11 eV strong enough laser to do this difficult experiment is a real challenge.
Why is that the case?
Well, I guess it's just that normal, you grab a random atom, the low-lying levels are not 11 eV separated, right? You get a population inversion, usually more in the infrared or visible. So nowadays you can make lasers at that frequency. Technology has improved, but in 1977 that was a real hard thing to do. And Howard Bryant, the lead investigator on this experiment, he was working at Los Alamos. And at Los Alamos, this was even before Star Wars, but they were making very high energy particle beams. And so they had an H- beam, which was relativistic. And in fact, this had a gamma, I think maybe it's mentioned, 1.853. So it's almost 2. And so he had the idea of firing the photons at the H minus from a visible laser. I think it says here it's from a nitrogen laser. It was 800 MeV H minus beam, and the photons. Oh, yeah, 3.678 eV. By doing this, he can Doppler shift these photons up to there. And now the other thing is, even at this kind of wavelength, it's not so easy to make a highly tunable frequency. So he had just a fixed frequency laser that he's going to fire upstream at the H minus beam coming out the laser beam. But he could tune it by having the ions in this beam. He could tune it by changing the angle relative to the beam. Right. And then that way he could sweep out and measure the cross-section, the resonances, as a function of frequency in the center of mass frame of the H minus ions.
Cool.
With 11 eV photons. Yeah, that really blew me away. So that's, I thought, a really cool thing. And I ended up predicting some other resonances, that if they see these, they have to see some others. And for a while, they were even calling the others the green resonance, but it didn't stick. It didn't end up in the final paper. Okay, anyway, that's all I wanted to say and show you this really cool example of a clever use of the Doppler effect to do something that was really hard to do otherwise. Next, I want to talk about how velocities add, which is a kind of a tricky thing. I think I was fairly confused by this subject when I was a student and first learned about this. Because in this problem, you have three velocities floating around. You've got a velocity you measure in frame K. You've got a velocity of some particle or whatever in frame K prime. And then you've got a third velocity, which is the relative velocity of the inertial reference frames. I was just did not understand that. It was too much for my little brain to comprehend. But now I get it. We just have to keep track of the different velocities, and it's not really rocket science. So I'm going to approach this as follows. I'm first going to derive the velocity addition theorem, if you like, or transformation law. I guess it's called addition because in Galilean relativity, right, it would just be u prime is u plus. Plus v, or plus or minus v. Not that hard in non-relativistic physics. But it's going to look different in relativity. Okay, so we're going to say a particle in frame K an inertial frame moves from one position, x1, x2, x3. Again, I'm not being careful of contravariant versus covariant now. Just think of these as ordinary three-dimensional vector to an infinitesimally displaced vector, x1 plus dx1, x2 plus dx2. x3 plus dx3 for the x, y, and z components in the time interval measured in frame k from t to t plus dt. Okay. Then observer k prime will see those two events. And they will measure those two events occurring at x1 prime, x2 prime, x3 prime, moving to x1 prime plus dx1 prime, x2 prime plus dx2 prime, x3 prime plus dx3 prime. We'll see those two events at those two positions displaced in times t prime to t prime plus dt prime. Okay, and all those two four vectors displaced by an infinitesimal are related, of course, by Lorentz transformation in the two frames. So I need new chalk. So now let's say that K prime is moving at velocity Vx1 hat along the x-axis relative to K, inertial frame K. And then the relation has to be dx0 is gamma. As I said, there are multiple velocities going to be floating around in this derivation, and there will be more than one gamma possibly could arise. So I'm always going to try to write the velocity associated with gamma as a subscript on gamma to make sure we know what velocity goes into gamma. Okay, so that Lorentz transformation will be relate the unprimed to the primed variables as gamma v times dx naught prime plus beta dx1 prime, and dx1 is gamma v dx1 prime plus beta dx0 prime. And of course, dx2 prime will be dx2, and dx3 will be dx3 prime, since the velocity was along x. So now we can find the ordinary velocity vector components of the particle. I'll call it ordinary velocity because next time I'll introduce the idea of a four-vector velocity, which means something a little different. But here, by velocity, I mean our usual concept of velocity. How many meters are covered in a given second? A real ordinary velocity, position change versus time. That's what I mean by velocity now. And in the two frames, there will be ui is going to be c times dxi dx0. You could write it, right? Since x0 is c dt, dx0 is c dt in frame K, and ui prime is c dxi prime dx naught prime. Okay. And so I can write u parallel by dividing dx1 by dx naught, and that'll be the velocity seen in frame K. And that will allow me to write it in terms of velocities in frame K prime. So the parallel components, I claim, will be C times dx1 prime plus beta dx0 prime divided by dx naught prime plus beta dx 1 prime. The gamma v's canceled out. So dividing numerator and denominator by dx naught gives c dx 1 prime dx naught prime plus beta over 1 plus beta dx 1 prime dx naught prime. Or in our more usual notation, the parallel component of velocity in the unprimed frame is the parallel in the prime frame plus the velocity, which kind of looks like velocity addition, but the denominator is a relativistic modification of Galilean transformation. It's 1 plus u parallel prime v over c squared. That's how the parallel component of the velocity changes. And we can derive how the perpendicular changes by taking one of these perpendicular components. That will be c times dx perpendicular dx naught, or c times dx perpendicular prime over gamma v dx naught prime plus beta dx parallel prime. And if we again divide numerator and denominator by dx naught prime, we get the perpendicular component transformation law. U perpendicular will equal u perpendicular prime. But now you might have thought it's not going to be modified, but it is modified because time is also changing in this frame, even though position orthogonal to v is not. So you get in the denominator gamma v times 1 plus u parallel v over c squared as the perpendicular velocity transformation law. And these are the transformation laws derived by Einstein. The relativistic velocity transformation laws. So this was a little harder than our derivation of the Doppler effect, which we could just do because we found an invariant, and then we knew, and we found a four vector through that argument, which we could then apply an ordinary Lorentz transformation. These are not an ordinary Lorentz transformation. But I'll have more to say about this next time, and then we'll introduce a velocity-like object that is a four vector that's much easier to transform, and you don't have to be quite so careful as we were here to derive it. Okay, so don't forget there's homework you can dive into. It's just two problems, and they're not very long. So I hope you won't feel cheated if this next homework assignment, it'll be just a little too easy for you, a little relativity stuff.
Maybe a little bit. It's a harder one.
You can come back and do the extra credit problem for last week, and I'll still give you credit for it if you do that. Okay.